Yeah. Unless there's something to drink.
It's called Education Model Review Committee.
Thank you.
And we do have stuff to see that. Before we start, I want to apologize for Kathleen having to cancel the last meeting because of session. And tonight, we will also have kind of an erratic committee meeting tonight. Legislators will be hearing a very, very important bill, and so we will probably be dashing up and down out of here if they call us to come to the floor. So just so that you know that if a call to house occurs, that Representative Hobson and Representative Igala and myself will be leading, and Jan will preside in behalf. So that's kind of the way things are going in these halls these days. Our schedules are kind of erratic, and the best laid plans have been totally torpedoed. We have with us tonight, we've been waiting for Dr. Conley, and she may want to explain. We have thought we were going to have for you tonight the final model, and you'd received a letter, I'm sure, from the speaker that was dated June 30th that says we'll get the final, and I guess there's still some editorial revisions that are being done still, but I'm assuming that there's enough content and enough information for you to complete your testimony to us and the information and sharing to us. So with that, Dr. Conley.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. For the record, my name is David Conley. I'm associate professor at the University of Oregon, and I served as the consultant to the quality education model that we developed. I'm here tonight at your invitation, basically, and at your service. I don't have a presentation to make to you. The presentation I did make in the form that it was is disjointed and sort of with the pages out of order and so forth. That was the presentation. And so tonight is a chance for you to have me available if you have a question for me that I can help answer, or perhaps even that you're more interested in talking with one another about issues and perhaps periodically asking me something if I can be of some use to you. So in that spirit, I had talked with Jan McCollum and had asked her if she would be receiving some materials in enough time to be able to review them, and she had said that she would get them to you a couple weeks in advance and asked if you did have any questions prior that she would forward them to me, and I guess nothing did come back to her, so I didn't prepare for anything specifically. But my assumption is you've had a little bit more of a chance to look at these materials now, and as a result, you may have some more detailed questions, and you may want to have a more extended conversation about any or all aspects of the model, or the principles that underlie it, or just some of the basic notions about improving schools or budgeting schools. So I'm basically here in any way that I can be of assistance to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to have specified what material that we received. You have to understand that the legislature in the last month or so, we've received a lot of material, and we've also received a lot for this committee, and so I think it would be it would help to clarify just maybe what we're talking off of tonight.
Here she is.
Maybe she doesn't even know we're waiting for.
Answer that question.
Awesome silence.
Yes.
So it's this test, this final draft.
Okay, the document is the final draft that's stamped and not for distribution. As I understand it, Dr. Conley, that probably is the all-inclusive document except for some editorial changes. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's my understanding as well. I've talked with a couple different people today who were involved in the getting it printed, and they both said pretty much the same thing, that it's not as pretty, and there's possibly some grammatical errors here still, but from a content point of view, you have really essentially the content.
With that, we can begin the question.
Madam Chair, Dr. Conley, one of the things I'm concerned about is in the final full implementation, because I really think that that's the way my mind is thinking about funding education, is the concern for what I call the creative arts, whether that is visual arts, drama, music, also early acquisition of a second language. And help me if you would, please. Is this, as I was reading it, I got an impression that that was sort of considered something that maybe we could get to, but that really wasn't going to be presented to the public as a model. Am I correct in that assumption?
Madam Chair, Ms. Gertenrich, the model includes, for example, at the elementary level, the notion of four program staff who address areas like music, art, second language at the school's discretion. The model doesn't presume to suggest exactly how a school would deploy that, because some schools already have invested in art programs and would want to use, if they were to have additional resources, they'd feel they already had a program, others would want to really develop it. We went ahead, working with Nancy Heiligman, going through the database, we did try to identify some schools that had sort of approximate characteristics to these prototype schools. And I want to emphasize that this was a very informal exercise that we did, but we just went did a little looking. And for example, in a couple of the elementary schools that we found have right now less than two FTE, less than two teachers devoted to the music, PE, art, second language area, and our suggestion in the quality ed model is that a quality elementary school would have, say, four positions. So in that sense, the model does accommodate the notion that it's an expense, that it's a cost, that it's a resource that should be addressed. But what it doesn't do is it does not mandate that school, prototype school, specifically says thou shalt use four positions in this way.
I can understand that, please. The reason why I ask that is, as I mentioned, since I'm new to Portland, I've been going around two of the different schools, elementary, middle, and high, and consistently, they have had to make a decision between, like an arts program or a second language, and an early childhood specialist. And they need that childhood specialist because a lot of the kids that are coming through have very serious problems, and they need that. And so what I was hoping for was some way that the model could address some of those things. So that's kind of where I'm at. What I'm seeing are tremendous needs there.
Madam Chair, Ms. Gertner, one other sort of principle upon which this model was developed was to try to maintain a balance between effective educational practice and local control, and not specify everything. And so I think this is an area where I think our assumption was, rather than telling every school in the state what we think is the proper way to set up an arts program or a music program or a second language program, the notion was these are resources that probably would help you go further in that direction than you can right now.
Mm-hmm.
But you're at the local level, as you said, a child development specialist might be a choice school something mm-hmm. to make and that others wouldn't.
Right. And last fellow question, do you see any way that the principal, the teachers, the parents don't have to make that difficult choice?
Madam Chair, in the current environment, I think, and probably for the foreseeable future, it will be a choice. I think this is that people have to make. This is a function of moving the funding from the local to the state level, as we've done over the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, I emphasize that the moving of the control over funding from the local to the state level was not a decision that was the primary policy objective of mm-hmm. the voters in 1990 when they passed Measure 5. I'm not trying to say it you know, some people might have wanted that to occur, but I don't believe it was the, sort of the primary purpose of that piece of legislation. It's been the effect of it. And as a result of that, I believe communities are going to be faced, continue to be faced with the trade-offs that you mentioned.
So there's no way around that, I guess. Huh? Like thanks, Angel.
Hello. Madam Chair, I don't know what the rules are and what you say, but I wanted to start with a statement before I ask my questions, and I have several. The statement has to do with my concern with a document like this is how it gets translated through the bizarre system, and then by the time it gets to the classrooms, it's something other than what was intended, and that's one of the reasons why I quit my teaching job and started working behind the scenes in this kind of capacity, because it is a really bizarre system where something starts at the top as a good idea and it goes through all the system, and then at the end it becomes a justification for cutting something. No matter what it is, it almost always ends up being filtered through into something like that. So you're a teacher, right?
I have a background in public education. I'm currently at the university.
Okay. I'm going to address one particular part in the model on page 49. Just as an example of the way that I look at this, and maybe you can help me to understand. It's the part that is under elementary education, and it says all day kindergarten. I've been out of education, actually out of my teaching position since I resigned in July of last year, and I've spent most of my time talking to teachers and parents. And I'm a parent of, as I said before, lots of kids, more than anybody in here. And I haven't found anybody who didn't have an opinion about whether a certain child should have an all-day or a half-day or a smaller class or a larger class. And my question about this, and just this one point, because it's like you could talk about hundreds and hundreds of different points inside the model. What makes all-day kindergarten the right solution for everybody? Because when it filters down through the system, there are some kids that are ready for all-day kindergarten, some kids that aren't. There are some kids that needed to start earlier, some kids that needed to start later, some kids that needed smaller class sizes, some kids that have special needs. And to put this in here, when it filters through the system, that's the way it is. So,
Mr. Colangelo, the model is, I think if the model were a series of prescriptions, in other words, if it were if the model were the state telling everyone that they must do certain things, I would absolutely agree with you. If the state said all Oregon school children will go to kindergarten all day long, whether they're ready or not, and here's the money to do it, I think your point would be absolutely on target. The model is designed to say, here are some things that if they are done, the likelihood of student achievement increases. Therefore, the state develops a budget off of this likelihood and then moves eventually to expect some levels of achievement from school. What it does not say is that every school will do it this way with every student. And it's basically, the model is a tool to talk about education policy for a state in terms of desired outcomes of student learning and practices that are associated with that. And all-day kindergarten, for the majority of students, is associated with more learning. And this is particularly true of lower-income students. All-day kindergarten is closely associated with greater advances, greater gains, learning how to read earlier. But the model is not something that prescribes this, requires it, enforces it, for all schools. So your conditions would still continue to exist, which is that each school district, each school, and hopefully each teacher and parent would make an individual decision about whether a student should be in kindergarten all day or not.
Can I do a follow-up? Okay, this is kind of to the teachers that understand how the system works. Am I wrong in saying that actually, you wanted me to put this down, didn't you? I start getting into this. Sorry. I'll put the mic down. When something like this filters through the system, and all the experience I've had, all the years of teaching, it doesn't give a choice. It ends up being that's what it's supposed to be. Am I wrong? Because the teachers are in here going, I'm just wondering if you were helping put this together, right? Is that a shock
what I just said, that that's what happens?
Madam Chair, Mr. Colangelo, absolutely not. The I can find plenty of schools in Oregon that have full-day kindergarten right now. And matter of fact, one of our validating schools has full-day kindergarten. I mean, full-day kindergarten is not a shock, and the idea...
Oh, I'm not talking about it.
I'm with you. And the idea that a document from the state might be interpreted by people locally to be a mandate rather than an option is not surprising to me. I'll give you an example. In Oregon, we had a thing called House Bill 2020, and a part of House Bill 2020 was that you could request waivers. Individual schools could request waivers from certain regulations if they wanted to offer a special kind of a school improvement program. They could apply to the Board of Education. And I analyzed the waivers the first couple of years that they came in. And what we found is over half of the waivers were requests to waive things that the schools were not required to do. In other words, they were asking for waivers for things that they weren't actually required to do. There was a sense that you couldn't change anything without asking for permission. And I think that you've hit on an issue here. Do we want schools that believe that all they can do is what they're told by the state to do, or do we want schools that build programs that, within a framework of effective practices, is responsive to the local community? And my sense is that a model like this provides the basis for local site councils and schools and parents, superintendents, to have discussions of this nature about what is best for their school and have a comparison point, something that is not in legislation, not in law, not State Board of Education policy, but in fact is something that guides good decision making. I think that puts parents in a better situation than where they are now, which is basically being faced with maybe the kind of budget cuts that you're talking about, which is, do we keep this teacher or this program? This talks about at least a framework that says, here are some effective practices, how do you make them work? And the school's responsible not just for implementing a program. Under the current model, schools are responsible to do what you said, which is implement programs. This is attempting to create a model, an environment in which schools are responsible for producing results. And if putting a kid in kindergarten causes them to learn less well, it would not make any sense to do that. You're describing schools that are highly bureaucratic and not particularly concerned about results. They're concerned about procedures. I'm describing a model that creates a framework within which schools have to think about the results, the effects, consequences of their decision.
Another follow-up, but I'm going to put that down. Using that same one point here on page 49 about kindergarten, I know I look at this too simplistically, but to me, if we really intended for it to not become a mandate, wouldn't it be something like all-day kindergarten or half-day kindergarten with half the size of class or half-day kindergarten with four-year-olds being able to do an early education program or... You understand where I'm going with this idea?
Madam Chair, Mr. Colangelo, absolutely. And that's the kind of work that we intend that would be done between now and the next session and the session after that as people went out and looked at schools that were effective, that were succeeding. What would happen is the variations on the prototype model would increase. This is basically a starting point that we've put here. And what we've said real clearly is that this is to begin to have it's a baseline where you start. And then what you do is you go out and you look at actual schools over the next 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, see who is achieving and who isn't. And the ones that are achieving at a level in excess of what one would expect, you go and look. And if it's a combination of these practices, you start to identify them.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
The research on all-day kindergarten versus the half-day and some of the other variations that you suggested, the full-day comes out looking better than all those from a research point of view.
It does?
Mm-hmm. I'm talking about in general, when you look at the preponderance of the studies, that they've exactly the model you talked about, which is splitting the classes and having the time versus increasing the time. I mean, these studies have been done. These comparisons have been done.
Dr. Carney, when the model of the prototype was put together, was there any discussion or consideration of mandates within that development? And we hear a lot about mandates and their effect on classrooms, and it also affects the teacher activity, all the other activities that go into classrooms. Did the council discuss that at all?
Madam Chair, what was discussed at various times was the fact that the policy environment in Oregon has changed between 1990 and the present, that the legislature is the new super school board, mm-hmm. and that the legislature can, at its will, produce laws that require schools to do pretty much whatever the legislature wants done, and that if you go back 10 to 15 years, that was less the case in Oregon. That was less frequent that the legislature would enforce a mandate on all Oregon schools, and that if we don't create an overall picture of what we want and then let the local schools make decisions, we are likely to drift toward mandating specific activities and elements. And I can give you a couple examples of those that are pending. For example, teaching about the Irish potato famine would be an example of a current measure that I don't think would have been put forward 10 years ago. But because the legislature is in charge of the, and I'm Irish, so I don't think it's a terrible idea, but the fact that the legislature does provide the budget and is responsible for the funding of schools, I think makes it more likely that we will see piecemeal mandates coming out versus an overall model that creates a framework within which schools make decisions as opposed to mandates.
Do you think that's because we have not addressed the fundamental questions, at the state level, if you will? I'm reminded of Superintendent Bunn in his testimony to us that we haven't addressed the question of what should education be in Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I was a little bit confused and maybe even, I still confused, I think would be the best word to use, about Superintendent Bunn's characterization of that fact, when I know that Boyd Applegarth spent over a year doing exactly that in the late 1980s with a committee that was designed to identify what the elements, the key elements of an education were, the core elements. And I know that report is available and that could be obtained without too much difficulty. And that would be perhaps a starting point. If Superintendent Bunn believes that has not been done, perhaps he'd like to start by taking a look at that document, because I respect Boyd Applegarth greatly, and the group that he assembled was a very high-quality group that spent quite a bit of time on that question. So hopefully it wouldn't be something that everyone felt we had to start over when Dr. Applegarth did what most people consider to be a quite effective job in that.
Representative
Irwin?
I think Martin
Bronstein from Corvallis. Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree that the points that Glenn was making earlier are pretty appropriate ones as part of the discussion. I don't look at the quality education model as being the document that seems to have mandated a whole bunch of things. In my recent experiences as a teacher, and Glenn asked that of all of us, the things that have seemed to become mandates that school boards run scared of are the directives from the State Department in relationship to the benchmark standards and some of those things that have come down as mandates and have really kind of pretty dramatically affected most of us in terms of what our professional lives look like these days. The discussions about an all-day kindergarten, which we have as an option in Corvallis and a few schools on a fee-based basis, have been pretty effective. But it sure would be a local call from the community standpoint to the school boards and site councils to make those kinds of determinations. So I look at mandates being, other than the ones that I think Dr. Conley just mentioned about things that are being legislated that we need to have in our schools, although I think the legislature is trying to be sensitive to that and not demand that these things happen, but they highly suggest that they happen in our schools. The discussion about uniforms and all of these other things that have been going on in recent weeks. But I do believe that the things that have come down through the State Department and that have been directed to school districts have made school boards and local communities run very scared of what is being directed as a mandate and what is not. I look at the model as being something to kind of shoot for in the way that What does best practices kind of tell us nowadays about what will be most effective for us to get our students to reach high achievement levels? Because that is really the goal of all of us as parents and teachers, and certainly as school board members and members on site councils. That's really the goal, I think, that everybody shares. I want Oregonian kids to really be well-educated, and I'm not so sure how we reach that, but we certainly have been rather restricted in terms of where we can go in terms of our local programs because our resources have been so severely damaged in recent years. And that, I think, is really one of the greater questions, although I think Glenn's concerns about that is a very, very legitimate one. That was more of an editorial comment than question. And my question was, thank you for allowing me to speak, and I'll speak when I get a chance. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I think this discussion about mandates raises a very important point, because we have this quality education model, and I certainly think there's been a lot of hard work and effort put onto this. But what we have, and it was acknowledged by a previous speaker, we now have a 90-member super school board. And we are going down a path that we all have to, I think, as we look at the quality model, as we have to realize that this is part of it, and I suppose it was inevitable once Measure 5 and its progeny were enacted. And it's interesting because just in today's or yesterday, there was a discussion about a bill that's coming out of the Senate about teacher salaries. And if this bill passes through, teachers won't have a whole lot to say or to bargain for. And a comment was made by one of the senators, well, we're paying for it. We're going to say how it works. And in the legislature so far this year, we have had bills passed that says you have to teach Eddie Eagle gun safety. You have to flag salute. And I'm not making any judgment as to the merits of these things. I'm just saying we have quite a few dictates or mandates, although some of them are more flexible. Some of them have may instead of shall, but in the potato famine and that type of thing. So I see this as part of the future and something to be extremely concerned about, because it may be difficult to even put the quality education model into practice.
Diane McKillop, English teacher, head of the English department at McMurray High School. I just have to make a comment about the bureaucracy that we're involved in, because the last 2 days, that's what I'm in the middle of. I am in the process of distributing to all of my teachers the results of the sophomore writing test that the sophomores took in January. The students I distributed the writing results to today, that's not what I had planned to do in class today, because I will see them today and then I will see them Thursday. At the same time, I was also distributing the results of their reading, state reading tests, today. So the bureaucracy has created, it's not a perfect bureaucracy that's created a system, and I won't share some of the comments of the students. It's like, what does this mean? And we don't even have time to evaluate it. And then there's a whole issue of teachers. So we've spent a whole bunch of time working and getting ready, and then we've waited and waited and waited. And the math has also a particular issue with problems with the test and refiguring and whatever. So teachers in the classroom and students are really at the mercy of bureaucracy. You have to understand at the same time, we are going to offer a SIM remediation as soon as school's out. We just got the scores. So there's a lot of imperfections and a lot of problems with the bureaucratic system, and those haven't been ironed out.
Madam Chair, I know there's no question in that, but if I might, a quick not even a response, but it's more of an agreement. Departments of Education historically have been about maintenance, in other words, maintain programs, and various forms of accountability. They check on things historically. They check how you spend your money. They check if you have enough books in your library. They help you get your federal money out to you and to make sure that you're spending it in proper ways. Historically, that's how they've been developed, how they've been structured, and what their duties and responsibilities have been. But in the last decade, around the United States, departments of education have been asked to move from that into the role of running large-scale assessment programs, large-scale improvement programs, assisting school districts, providing leadership around educational change and reform, developing whole new programs about transition from the world of school to the world of work, for example. What that results in is structures that are not consistent with the tasks and the challenges that they face. And what you, the results you get is you get inefficiencies and you get errors and you get what I believe to be a lack of responsiveness to the needs of the client. In this case, clients are teachers, clients are students, and their parents. Now, having said that, I mean, that's not an indictment, that's a description. But I believe it's another place where leadership from the legislature and others is going to be very important in reshaping the Oregon Department of Education. I think it's ready to be reshaped.
Mm-hmm. Along that line, you know, we've talked about assessment here and testing, and did the council discuss those impacts as it puts together the framework for the model? Because, you know, when you do the framework for the model, you're talking time. And assessment and testing is also a part of time, and it appears to some of the frustration that we've heard both from the teachers as well as students is tied to some of those issues. And if you're going to put the prototype together, it appears to me that time element has also got to be a part of that prototype.
Madam Chair, the committee did look at the notion of time, not of the notion of state assessments and their impact, but the notion of time, and concluded that a portion of students are going to need more time, that not all students necessarily need the same amount of additional time, and that teachers need more time, but that not all teachers need the same amount of additional time, and that the model should accommodate that notion by making it clear that some additional resources are called for, particularly during an implementation period, that during an implementation period of a new policy that creates particular, unique, and excessive strains on an organization, and that during that period in particular, that the needs of teachers and students to be provided extra time should be addressed.
Okay. Tiffany Tate, I just have a question. I'm unclear on, to me, when I've looked through the model, I don't understand. Sometimes to me the model doesn't match what's happening in our assessment. And one of the things that I wrote down that you said was the state will expect some levels of achievement. And I guess that makes me a little nervous because, you know, to me here this says 90%. And, I mean, I would love that. But when when this doesn't particularly give a way to assess that 90%, how are we going about assessing that? I'm not explaining this very well, but it concerns me that this doesn't match currently how we're assessing children, and so I'm unclear on what that means when you say that they're going to expect this level of achievement.
Madam Chair, Ms. Tate, the assumption is that the assessment system is the means to assess the level of performance. What the model doesn't presume to say what the state assessment system ought to be. What it says is that the state has adopted certain content standards, certain benchmarks, and now an assessment system, and that for now at least that's the law of the land, and that the model would in fact, whatever assessment system the state developed, the model would attempt to produce achievement in relationship to that assessment system. The model is designed around generalized student achievement. It's not designed to be specific to a particular type of student achievement. It's not a model that's designed to produce mastery of basic skills at the expense of cognitive development, for example, nor is it a model that is so experiential that we'll never know what the student has mastered at a basic level. So in that sense, the model is responsive to or adaptable to the assessment system that the state produces, and the quality education model, the council did not presume to try to prescribe an assessment system. It just said, whatever the state's using, that'll be it. And the model was that. So that's why you didn't see that information in there.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I'd like to disagree with something that you said. The idea that our teachers need the extra time now, and once the implementation is there, perhaps they might need less. I would say that we're never going to be there, we're continually going to be on the travel, and they will always need time to learn these new things. But putting that aside, you pushed my button there, we've been talking about accountability, and it's of particular interest here because we had a bill, maybe it's kids in ages, if it reached a third grade benchmark, they'd be held back, and we have one circulating now that would grade schools A, B, C, D, F. So I think the accountability piece put together with the assessment piece, which I realize isn't included within the model, but I would ask if you could spend a minute integrating accountability, assessment, and how those two real important factors relate to the model and what it does to provide a framework or what it does to connect them.
Madam Chair, Representative Hobson, I think the model really is part of what you'd probably call a three-legged stool in that sense. You also have to have assessments, and you also have to have your instructional program, which is of your own design. The model is a framework, basically, to say, here is one way to do things that could reasonably be expected to produce a certain level of achievement. Now, quite frankly, we don't know what that level is yet. But conceptually, the model is probably about clarifying what's expected of schools. Now, I have to say that there's an upside and downside to that. In some cases, I think some schools and some educators will find that to be a disquieting notion, that we are going to clarify what we expect of schools. That can be viewed as restricting. That can be viewed as taking away autonomy. That can be viewed as invading their practices in the classroom. On the other hand, if we do go ahead with some form of accountability, like letter grades for schools appearing in the newspaper, or as many states have done, simply publishing the test scores, ranking the schools. I have those for Nevada at home. I'm doing some work in Nevada. You just rank them and end the discussion. That's another form of accountability. So on the one hand, the notion of accountability can be threatening. On the other hand, the practice of it can be very crude and, I think, counterproductive. The quality education model does, in fact, need to be linked to an accountability system, and it is, in fact, about greater accountability for schools. But it's an attempt to put that accountability into a framework that's linked to student learning and that tries to give every school the tools to succeed and tries to make it possible for all schools to be able to reach a certain level of achievement, as opposed to a model that would grade all schools, for example, in which my prediction is the schools that are well off are going to do well. The schools that aren't well off aren't going to do well. We'll basically be grading the neighborhood's economic power or the economic resources as opposed to the quality of the school. And that sends the wrong message to the educators, and it sends, I believe, the wrong message to our society about where you want to live, for example. So I think that we're going to have accountability, and therefore a model that links it to effective practices that are likely to increase learning is a better framework within which that accountability, for which that accountability, within which that accountability can occur or be put forth by the state. So that's what I believe is the positive about this model, but I don't want to deny that it is about increased accountability.
Pat, is that Mark from Salem? Can you hear me? I don't know how my voice is going. But Madam Chair and Dr. Conley, I really thank you for your very lucid discussion about all of this, and I really admire all the work that has gone into this. There are two points that are of a concern to me, and one is for defective practices, time. And I agree that time is vital. You must have that. The concern I have is how we are dealing with time. We're concerned sometimes about whether the legislature is going to mandate all this or whatever. But when I start to hear the squeeze on time, I really think that it's more building decisions. It's very local decisions that are being made that we as teachers, as parents, as community members, have a lot to influence the decision makers about that. For example, I know that some of us are on block schedules, some of us are on time assistance, some of all these other things going on. If I even look at my own building, I start to see some uses and misuses of time that are very disturbing to me, whether it's students out in the hall for whatever reason,
or on a block schedule when they're assuming that you're going to have a greater amount of time for students to learn, and yet they're taking breaks in this block, which kind of defeats the whole idea of this long period of time. Anyway, there are small kind of interruptions beyond belief that are occurring with coming in late classes, announcements coming in, this is going out for some effect, this is going out for term entrance. Everything has its good cause, but they are terribly interruptive to the educational process in the classroom. And I don't, that's not mentioned, you were talking more, I think, in time, maybe in a different way in this practice. But I think those of us in the trenches are feeling that time grabbed in many ways, including the assessments, as I already mentioned, and having to do those. The other aspect of time, I think, is how we're using the time that we have. And correct me, but I'm not seeing the word articulation or how we are developing programs over time that dovetail into one another, whether it's music, whether it's foreign language, whether it's history or science, that, okay, so we start in kindergarten, but what are we teaching in kindergarten? Mm-hmm. So we're starting a program in ninth grade, but how is that connected to anything? We have all these enrichment classes or whatever, but how is it related to everything else? We have a lot of programs that start in foreign language that don't dovetail into anything,
mm-hmm.
that are just, oh, we're just going to have this little conversation class, and then the person keeps having to start all over again at level one because they really don't know enough to dovetail to really hit proficiency. And aren't we really talking about becoming proficient in whatever, mm-hmm. whether it's art, music, or, you know, science, or foreign language, or English, and how do we get that proficiency? There's been a lot of studies done in foreign language that show time after time after time that the biggest factor is articulation.
Mm-hmm.
Another factor is the choice of the training and the choice of people who are doing the teaching. And that's very troublesome now, too, as we're having tremendous turnover. And the power of hiring is a local decision. That's not determined by the legislature. That's another area that I think we need to address and be really frank, because if we don't have somebody who knows the subject area who's an effective teacher, no matter all the stuff that we write in here, it's not going to get delivered. So those are a couple of concerns that I have, and maybe I'm not seeing how it's all being pulled together. Maybe you can help me.
Madam Chair, Ms. Moss, you had three things there, and I managed to capture them. So I'd have to repeat them, but try to go through them one at a time. When we talk about use of time, I think there's really two ways that the model gets at this in the ways that you talked about it. One is, I think the model in general encourages efficiency. It encourages school people to think about the way they're using their resources better. Because of the accountability piece, I've been a principal and an assistant principal in school. I've been a classroom teacher. I've seen it kind of from those two perspectives. I've been a central office administrator in two different school districts, including an assistant superintendent. And I've sort of seen it from that point of view. And in every case, what you find is that schools are places where adults are making accommodations. And they're making accommodations because they're all kind of in there together. And I hate to say trapped, but I mean, in some senses, I mean, you can spend your whole career in one building. And you'd better not get anyone too angry with you. So schools are places where people try to get along and tolerate each other because they're in close proximity. And the effect of that very often is to cause all sorts of adjustments and accommodations to be made that don't necessarily address the core business of schooling, but address how can the adults best survive in this environment together. And I think one of the things, first of all, that the model does is it, at the very least, creates a common reference point for the adult decision-making, which says we have this expectation the state's put forward, and we have, both in terms of performance and in terms of effective practices, that, gee, we should take a look to see where are we in terms of this performance and in terms of these effective practices. Which takes me to the second part of the model that relates to your first point, which is that the model talks about intangible elements as well as tangible. A lot of what you're going to see about grading schools is going to be what are things I call tangibles. Things are pretty, you know, right out there. But the model also opens up a new category, things like principal leadership, things like colleagueship and school climate, perceptions of teachers about the work environment, perceptions of parents about the quality of school. The ways in which time is used within a classroom, for example. the model has in it this notion of intangibles, which are things that are related to student learning. In other words, they're what I call achievement correlates. You don't pick an intangible just because it's interesting. You pick it because there's some evidence that it's related to student learning. But you look at these things. And schools that have dysfunctional relationships among the adults are not places where student learning improves. I mean, you can document this. I mean, it can be shown and has been demonstrated through any number of studies of individual schools. So things like that, what you described about the way time is used, are symptomatic of a lack of communication among the adults, and they're symptomatic of a lack of what you call articulation, which is there's, you know, vertical and horizontal. I mean, horizontal, vertical. That there's articulation within a school among people's activities. In other words, that might be focus. And then there's vertical, which is across grade levels. So the model gets at some of these things through the intangibles, not all of which are in place yet. When we put it together, I put an initial list together, but I believe that the intangible list would be refined over the next couple of years. So that's point one. I'll try to go through the others. I did talk about the articulation piece, and the model doesn't address articulation. And I think that's, you know, I can look at that as an error, but here's why it didn't do it. The reason it didn't is because in Oregon, curriculum is a local issue. And it was not appropriate to step into an arena where state policy at this point does not have authority. So we did not put things in place that appeared to be the mandating of curriculum across grade levels. But certainly it's an element that if we refine this, we would try to think about it further. But it's so highly sensitive that we kept very far away from it. I'm going to make an editorial comment here and say that I believe we're going to have to come to grips with this lack of addressing, of being willing to talk about curriculum when we're going to talk about content standards and assessments, and then pretend as if we don't have to talk about curriculum. Every other standards-based system in the world talks about the curriculum you have to have. I'm not saying we have to mandate it, but I'm saying we're going to have to come to grips with this issue. That's an aside. The third thing we talked about was teacher training. And all I can do there is to say, once again, the model didn't get into it because all we did is create prototype schools, and I don't even think our intangibles got into that very well. Some of my writings in other areas personally address that, and I work in a teacher education institution, and in that context I've done some things. And through some of my other work on a thing called proficiency-based admissions, I've done some work in that area with TSDC. So, I agree with you, but you're right, the model absolutely just does not address it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, if I've been listening and also looking at this document, I'm not so sure that when this was looked at and discussed and that it was done as holistically as possible. And let me tell you some of my concerns, and they've been raised here. One is, if you look at Part 5, Policy and Politics of the Oregon Educational Environment, you actually focus on the funding, the funding, Measure 5 and so forth, and also, to some extent, the Reform Act, the Educational Act. But I think that you have to look at it in a broader context, because it is only looking in a broader context that you're going to find out, is your model, the cost and so forth, actually going to work? And here's what I'm talking about. For example, the education department and the impact that they have, and a lot of times at the school level they feel like there's a lot of dictates or mandates or whatever you call them. And maybe that's really part of another study, I don't know. But I think the education department has to be factored in here and how they operate and so forth, because it just follows. They have an impact on funding and so forth. The other thing that's really not in here is the legislature, and that came to mind when you were talking about curriculum as a local issue. I think once the Reform Act was passed, certainly there is certainly a local aspect left. But when you say to somebody, this is going to be the outcome, you are of necessity saying something about the input to get to the outcome, and the input is curriculum. So that's why I say when we look at this, I think you've done a tremendous job, but I think it could have been brought in a broader context, because all of those things are going to influence the cost of education and how we get to where
So hopefully we want to go.
Madam Chair, Representative Rubella, one of the things that I've noticed is that school boards in particular, board members in particular, I don't believe have sort of internalized the fact that the whole policy landscape has changed and that their role really has changed.
Mm-hmm.
So I would agree with you that more should be done to convey this more holistic picture about the nature of the changes. And I would suspect that the reason the model is the way it is that it probably went as far as anybody thought you could go in one step. That I would suspect that most of us probably thought if you went too much further, it would just, people couldn't internalize it. And so one of the things that I've been, that's been really interesting for me to see is that since this has been read by people in the school board organization and so forth, they're in the school administrators organization, they've both been saying, well, we need now to get this out to our members to get them thinking about how their role changes as these things begin to happen. And I don't know that it's had much effect on the Department of Education, quite frankly, but that's not to say that it might not. So between now and the next session, the kind of work you suggested, I think, is certainly a call for and would contribute a lot.
Mm-hmm. Linda Bajorn from Gresham Bartle. Madam Chair and Dr. Coleman, I want to echo that sentiment. And I read in here, even on page 99, where it says a partnership for accountability. In the final analysis, schools exist to meet the needs of children within a framework created by the state. The Oregon Quality Education Model is but one element of a multidimensional system of policies and procedures that, when properly aligned, can send consistent messages to teachers, principals, superintendents, boards of education, parents, lawmakers, and the larger community. And really, I think that is one of the greatest sources of frustration at our level, is that we do not get a consistent message from the state regarding this model, regarding curriculum, regarding funding, regarding assessment. It seems like every faction, every committee that's working on something different, none of them integrate, none of them align with each other. And so we get, you know, all these inconsistent messages, and that is a problem. And I don't think that this model can be considered complete until it is aligned somehow with these other factions that enter in, so that we can get a consistent picture, so that we can make sense of what we're being told. You know, you said just a moment ago, curriculum is a local issue in Oregon, and yet we have bills in the legislature dealing with specific curriculum. That's at the state level. And we're left, you know, at the local level saying, okay, what does that mean if it's supposed to be a local issue? Those are the sorts of things that I see the frustration level being raised because of those sorts of things.
Madam Chair, Ms. Verdorn, I think that this notion of what the model does is try to paint a new picture. And so in that sense, it's incomplete. And in my own work, what I've done is I put together, separate from this, actually, I put together a multi-page kind of analysis of all of the different policy, what I call policy levers that exist in the state, all the things that a state board can do, a legislature can do, schools can do, and so forth, and all the systems that exist, and laid that all out, and then laid out the statutory basis, and then laid out the ways in which the messages are now starting to send. And I think that type of work probably needs to be put together in a way that is distributed to boards of education and to superintendents and to legislators and the Department of Education to make it clearer where these inconsistencies exist from the point of view of policy and from the point of view of teachers. And my hope is that between sessions, that kind of an intelligent, informed, dispassionate conversation could occur over an extended period of time so that as people enter the next round of, and even as Boards of Education currently made policy and as we enter the next legislative session, people would have some sense about the inconsistencies that existed from the point of view of teachers. So it's a piece of work I think that's very important to get done. And I've done a little bit on it.
Dr. Carney, did the council discuss or think about how the local budgets would integrate or merge, if you will, if you're here at a model at the state level and you're doing your budgetary work at the local? local level, and how does that then integrate, or what effect does it have? Because I don't see that in the model. I see that you've got a local board here that is doing budgetary work, and then you've got a model cost up here that's doing something else. So how do they meet and come together?
Madam Chair, that actually, you're very correct in your assessment that the model does not talk about distribution of funds. It's an allocation model. Therefore, it does not address the way in which a local board responds to the specifics of the model. And I think that's by design at this point, is to say that, once again, back to Mr. Colangelo's point, that we don't want to appear to be mandating particular practices locally. Also, given that schools have been quite autonomous for a very long time, you have tremendous variation in Oregon among the schools. And I think the committee wanted to acknowledge the fact that different schools would make very different decisions, but that the goal would still be the same. The goal of heightened student achievement relative to state benchmarks and assessments would still be the same, but that if a school felt they could get there a different way, the district and the school board felt they could budget differently to do that, that was really their prerogative.
Did the council look at schools that were successful to do some comparisons with those schools in Oregon that have achieved some of the standards that the model was attempting to address?
Madam Chair, the analysis was done more on a national level and was done more from a research base than from individual schools, and there are several reasons for that. One reason is the state assessments have barely been in place long enough to start to draw conclusions. Another reason is that the council was simply not funded with the ability to go out and examine individual schools. But I think more importantly, the design principle was one that said this should not be something that results from an analysis of several schools. It should be something that appears that is conceivably generalizable across over 2,000 Oregon schools. And that once it's put into place, the process you described would then be activated, which would be to start seeing which schools, as they use the model, had more success and which had less, and why they had more success. And from that, once we had the same rules in play, essentially, for everybody, by rules, I mean rules of the game. In other words, everyone knew what the model was and knew what the expectation for performance was and had a funding level associated with those expectations. In that context, then, it would make more sense to take a look then at the performances, keeping in mind that we just reached full implementation on funding equalization. So if we go back far at all and we start looking at school performance, we're really examining, in some cases, the effects of very different funding levels, because we've had that in the past in Oregon. We have very different funding levels for individual school districts and school buildings.
Representative Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to ask that same type of question, because our experience, or at least mine, with the charter school movement was to discover that there are some school districts, like 4J and Eugene, that are, you know, light years ahead of other school districts. And there needs to be a clearinghouse of information of best practices. Okay, jumping from there to what you're talking about, the State Department, I think, has to develop a clearinghouse of information of best practices that can be shared in at the same time this model is being implemented. It can't, you know, they have to happen together. And I think as a result of the charter school passage, districts now are going to be more open to looking at what other districts are doing in a lot of areas. I mean, because they're going to have to. They're going to be faced with people coming for sponsorship. And it's going to open up a whole new awareness, I believe, in many school districts to implement something like this. And so I think the best practices clearinghouse would be a step that needs to be
taken. Madam Chair, Representative Morissette, the Department of Education's accountability model has a provision to identify high-performing schools, or what they call exemplary schools, and make those models then available. The problem is I think it's going to take a little time. But I know they have that provision in mind, and they have that intention in mind. But once again, I just had mentioned this is an example of a new role for Department of Education. They just haven't done these kind of things with it.
Madam Chair and Dr. Conley, I'm Jennifer Ross. I'm looking at the accountability piece, and I will apologize because I know that I'm emotional about it, and I wish I could address it differently. But as I sit and listen to the whole conversation, in my head are 25 second graders, and I know their background. And so as I look, for example, on page 99, and it says that part of the local boards will need to be ensuring each school is staffed with the most capable and competent adults available. I think I have two parts to me, concern about what we're discussing. And part of it probably should have been addressed to Stan Bunn the last time we were here, because part of my question is, have we really set standards that we want to follow up on? Are we prepared for the stress and the pressure that we want to put on teachers and students to follow up on what we've set up for ourselves? And I think that will harm having quality teachers in education. I will not presume to call myself quality, but if I speak from a personal level, I don't know how long I will stay and do what I do every day, caring for these kids and trying to follow through on what's being mandated by the standards, which, as I know, this is about implementing and not about the standards. My second concern, though, is about this. We talk about accountability, and I look at, for example, the model recommends that the district improvement plan also include three things on page 101. It says that they would like to include the dropout rate as they look at the district, the percentage of students meeting the standards, and the percentage of students, how they've changed over the last 3 years, how they've changed. And my concern is that as a citizen, as a person, I fear that in education we are moving farther and farther and farther away from the human element of what's happening in schools and what's happening in our society. And I fear that by saying we're going to hold teachers accountable for this or education accountable for this, at the bottom level, it feels like it's being legislated that teachers make up the slack for all of society's woes. The lack of parenting, and the lack of preschools, and the lack of morals, if I could say that, and where we're at and saying kids need to be educated, but we're going at it with a high pressure, high stress, meet the standards when kids are not coming to school feeling loved, feeling fed, feeling all those things. I sense those are the intangibles that the model has tried to cover. I fear that with accountability, it will come in that it says schools need to do this, but it will be left the same people who have been out there all along to just take more responsibility and shoulder more. And I wonder, will we really receive the support we need to do the things that are being proposed?
Madam Chair, that's why the model was developed. Because we've been implementing school reform in this state for 8 years without ever costing it out, without ever talking about what the effects on teachers are, without ever considering what we need to do to begin to reorganize schools. We have not addressed those underlying issues. What we've simply done is said, here's a new set of standards, here's a new set of assessments. Please get all the kids to do this, and oh, by the way, we're going to increase your class sizes and cut down on all your support. I mean, it's a total counterintuitive approach. It doesn't make sense what we've done in the last 8 years as a system.
Mm-hmm.
The model's an attempt to break that spiral,
yeah,
and to say, as it does, you may need some more resources to get this done. You may need to target some resources at some of the earlier grades, certainly at the beginning of this. You may need to do some reducing of those class sizes. You may need to put a curriculum specialist into the school to help the teachers in some of these areas. You may need to extend the time that some students have to take to get to the standard. You may need to have volunteer coordinators in some schools. You may need to increase the number of counselors in some schools because kids are going to bring problems with them of a differing nature. You may need to reimburse teachers for their out-of-pocket expenses even a little bit. These are the kind of things that the model says are minimally necessary. Because the model is not a basic skills implementation plan. This is not about, by gosh and by golly, let's just make sure everybody can read and then forget the whole rest of that educational endeavor. This is about saying a quality education is the development of children as human beings, which a big part of that is literacy and number skills and some other things, but also along with that are the arts, the quality of interaction, sports, extracurricular activities, innovative curriculum, technology, enough books, roofs that don't leak. This is what it takes to keep people in the profession. This is what it takes to have children feel that they are loved. You don't want to bring them into schools that are horrible, falling down, terrible environments. The model is a holistic approach. It doesn't just look at the standards. And if it just said, if the model said, look, let's put some tutors in all the schools, or there's a program right now called Success for All. It's a research-based model by Bob Slavin. People all over the country are adopting it willy-nilly, and it's about increasing reading in kindergarten to third grade. It's a pretty good thing. But if I were before you today saying the answer to all the problems in Oregon is to adopt Success for All, as is occurring in many other states, I would be guilty, of being insensitive to a lot of what you just addressed. The model, I believe, is an attempt to address what you've raised, to say we're not going to keep people if we don't create environments in which the teachers can have success, the kids can have success, and it's a reasonable place to work. So, I think you said it very well, and hopefully the council has attempted to respond to that.
Jennifer.
If I could add to one of the things you said, you listed out it's not just reading and math, but the arts and the sports and all those things. At the base of my human nature, I would have to say we have to add heart. It's about children's hearts. Mm-hmm. And if their teacher is so worried about getting them to meet the benchmark and wondering if they're going to lose their job because of this accountability thing, I think it would be great if we could be careful with the way that we communicate things to teachers. If we could communicate that teachers, we believe in you and we want to give you the best that we have so that you can do your job, I believe we're doing a favor. If we communicate that teachers, we need these standards up, and if you don't do it, we will get somebody who will, it causes more and more stress. And on another personal note, if my kids walk into my classroom on a day when I am highly stressed, they don't feel loved by me. But if my kids walk into my classroom on a day when I'm pretty confident of what's happening and I'm doing all right, they go away with a different game than any academic game can give them. And I don't see much of our legislation addressing that and addressing how do we acknowledge and how do we encourage teachers so that teachers can in turn encourage kids and so that we in turn can begin to be a positive building on each other's society instead of continuing to put more stress to try to prove what we can do.
And then, Chairman Roth, you bring up a wide range of issues, and let me address only one of them. That in my own work, once again, separate from the model, but I think it's very compatible with what we're talking about. I'll be speaking with Senate leadership tomorrow about how, if you're going to try to hold people accountable in schools, to use a measure as simplistic as a letter grade for a school isn't going to be a very effective way to do it. It's going to have the kind of results that you're talking about. But if we're It may be more reasonable when we look at schools to look at not just test scores, but also look at some other things that are associated with effective educational practice. In other words, if your faculty is trying hard, if you're aligning your curriculum, if you're working as teams, if you have a staff development program that is an effective one, if you're doing the right things, even if the test scores haven't gone up, in my conception of how this works, your school should still be praised. Because they will go up eventually. And it should not be a situation where you are told that they have to go up in 12 months. It should be a situation in which you know that if you're doing a good job, if you have the content knowledge, or let's say you don't and you get it, go get that knowledge. And you can show that the teachers are taking the classes they need to enhance their skill in science, let's say. That school ought to be viewed as a highly effective school. So, the model doesn't get into the specifics of an accountability strategy, but in my own thinking and in my own work that I'm doing, some of it with this legislature, and with the Department of Education, I'm promoting a broader sense of accountability, a broader sense of excellence, and a broader sense of achievement, one that acknowledges when educators are doing the right things and that ought to be rewarded and publicly recognized.
Dr. Carney, and just to follow up on Jennifer, the model does not include the broader community, and it does not include those impacts that the teachers have no control over. You know, when you talk about in classroom, and it's kind of interesting because there is the assumption within it that the classroom is responsible for all aspects, and I think that's what Jennifer was saying. So the parents' involvement and those kinds of things aren't there. There's also the assumption that the SIM is the basis for all the standards and the achievement, and that hasn't been validated yet.
Well, Madam Chair, the model takes into account things like parent participation and involvement in the school as intangibles that are to be incorporated in when reviewing the effectiveness of the school, absolutely. As far as validating the SIM, I do think that you do have, it is kind of a problem of chicken and egg here. I mean, we could use standardized achievement tests. They have been validated. And we could say that we want to see improvements on something like the Stanford Achievement Test or the Terranova or any of the standardized achievement tests. It could be done. The problem, I think, though, and they're highly validated, but I think the problem is that those tests don't spell out in enough clarity what a teacher should be doing the way that benchmarks do. And I realize that the system is still new and still being learned, but once I think it's in place, and once people have done the kind of curriculum alignment that we're talking about here, it becomes a more manageable system than one that's based on standardized achievement tests that are normed nationally.
Diane McCullough. I'd like to add to what Jennifer said. Once the students arrive at school, they also are faced with teachers without tools. And in Oregon, we are so far behind in terms of books for students. We are so far behind in terms of enough money for printing to carry out the assessment, the open-end reading assessments, and all the things that are being asked of us. Our teachers do not have time to create work samples, to score work samples, to work together. Again, you'll have to excuse me, but I'm an English teacher, and we are dealing with classroom sets of old literature books, and we don't have any writing books. And Dr. Conley, I wonder what it would be like for a university professor to teach a course without a bookstore where students would buy their books. I mean, we are so far behind where we need to be to even get started implementing this model in Oregon. And I would love to mandate that all our decision makers have to spend a week in a public school before they arrive here to make decisions. And I don't think we'd be reading some of the stuff we're reading in the newspapers, because they are way out of touch of where we are and how sad it is for the tools that we are not giving teachers to teach.
Oh, man, I'm sure. Once again, the model has categories for computer hardware and software, supplies, books, and materials that include text, consumables, classroom sets, classroom materials, all equipment, supplies, copying, media center materials, teacher reimbursement, and material purchases, that set those at levels that we anticipate begin to make up some of that shortfall. Once again, when we go to the validating schools, when we go and look at some schools and compare them, we find no money being spent on computer hardware and software, no budget category, depending totally on grant money. We find textbook purchase budgets that are not adequate. So what the model does is creates a framework that says this is an expectation. And one of the pressures always on school budgets, I know from having been a school administrator, is that you start taking your money out of those budgets. And what the model tries to do is set some baselines that say, if you don't have X number of dollars in this category, it's not a mandate, you don't have to do it, but you should explain to your community why you don't have the money there. So one of the things that the model tries to do is something that an individual school can't do. Your department can't very well argue for more money. It just sounds like you want more for you. But if you have a model that says, here is averages around the state adjusted for what is believed to be minimally effective results, you at the very least have a tool in your hand to say, this is what our district should be thinking about. And that's basically the rationale behind the model.
Dr. Carney, the quality ed model, and it projected $4.95 billion, that says that it will start us down the road to improvement. But we're hearing that from the school districts that $4.95 is a no-cut budget. So if that's accurate, how is it going to start us down the road to improvement?
Madam Chair, I've been in meetings with superintendents, and I've heard superintendents, some of them say we'll be cut at this level, some say it's no cut, I've heard some say we'll have more money. So I'm not sure, because I don't deal specifically with the school-based budgets and the district budgets. I know what the effects in general will be on schools, that some schools have unique circumstances, some districts do, I think most notably Portland. But because of equalized funding, schools as a whole may in fact be able to do some, at the very least, some reallocating, and perhaps even take a look at investing some of these funds. I think when I look, for example, at how one district said they were going to spend money that came at 4.95, they were going to do a lot of deferred maintenance. If a district does that, they're going to say they don't have the money to improve. We would say, while maintenance is important, it's also important to invest. If we knew we were going to implement this model properly, remember, this is phased implementation. And if some of the districts are going to look at this and say, it's not phased implementation, it's more money, and I'm never going to get more money again, so I'm going to fix everything I can right now. But if it really were phased implementation, and 2 years later it would be phased up to the fourth and fifth grade, and 2 years later, sixth, seventh, and eighth, you wouldn't have to dump all your money into deferred maintenance if you felt you had some reasonable probability of dealing with it on a regular time schedule. So I think what some people are calling no-cut budgets are budgets that go after meeting deferred needs of various sorts. Now, I'm not saying specifically that's the case. What I'm saying, at the very least, I've heard discussions. I've heard the Springfield School District, for example, say they're going to take some federal money and use some of their own funds to reduce class size K-3. I've heard the Eugene School say that they're going to be doing some of this. I've seen districts already responding to the general outlines of this and trying to show the public that they would be responsive were they to receive additional funds.
This goes back to what Jennifer was talking about. And before I say what I'd like to say, I want to start by saying for you, Dr. Connolly, this is not an attack on you. I'm sitting next to a teacher that knows two languages, right, really well. And to me, Jennifer is speaking a different language than you're speaking, because I understand what she said and how she said it and how she feels about all this. And I think I understand what you said and how you feel about it. And the differences between those two languages and the person that, if you could take one person and have them present the Oregon education, quality education model to all the schools, the language that they speak might be the biggest difference in how the whole thing is interpreted. Because if Jennifer stood up and explained to teachers that are dealing with kids who have all kinds of problems and she's trying to love them every day, which is the language that I think I understand better, the teachers and the whole school system takes this differently. And if somebody stood up and spoke the language that you speak, then I'm not saying that's against you. I'm talking about the way that I understand it and the difference between teaching at the university and teaching second graders every day that have all kinds of problems and not having the books and not having the stuff and the help and all those other things that's happening. I think that the difference in who presents this is going to make maybe the biggest impact on it.
Mr. Colangelo, I would invite you to come to some of the speeches that I do at school. You might hear it presented a little differently.
Dr. Tommy, first a statement and then almost a motion, I think, and I will make a motion. Last night I went to hear Mary Piper up at Lewis and Clark. Mm-hmm. You know, she's Surviving Ophelia, and her new book is The Other Country, which is my age. But anyway, it was really interesting. She made a statement that really stuck with me. And she says that our children are suffering from lap time. Now, in the second grade, that's physical lap time. In the high school, that's the gift of time. They want somebody to talk to. And the teachers are so involved in dancing, standing their head and spinning nickels almost to do the things that are being required. So I think that what Glenn is saying, you got to look at that. And I think that's what, as voters, is going to appeal to the public. Now, what I want to say as far as the business at hand, I agree with what Representative Uberall said, and also about doing the whole spiel at one time, not just the model, which I think I respect and a lot of good work is put in here. But I do think that you have to, although, you know, this local control and all that, I do think if you're going to have expectations and standards, you got to say, for what? And I think you got to put the pressure on the Department of Education. And I'm not bad-mouthing anyone, but in order to get stuff done, you can't, say, oh, well, I got to do this one step and see if it works. model. It means making sure that the Department of Education is going to come up with some things that all the teachers here are saying, and I think that we need to start doing that, saying what are we trying to do with education. And so, Madam Chair, I usually, if I were going to do something like this, make sure I had enough votes before I could. <No. laughs> But I really move from what I'm hearing, that people want to have our children educated well. And it includes the model. It includes saying what, you know, a good education is. And it includes getting the Department of Education to really move and get things done. Because otherwise we're going into the year 2000 and we're still saying, well, you know, and I don't think that's how we make change in our country. Maybe it's because of some child of the Second World War where you did it. So, and all these discussions will be a part of our work study group. Okay, but Andy, and then, but what I'm saying, so, maybe I won't move today, but I am going to make a motion, so it's on paper. You know, everyone voted yes or no.
My name's Andrew Pate, and I teach in Gresham Ballas School District as well. And I guess I really agree with what Carol just said. In a lot of ways, I think that having what the State Department of Education's expectations are needs to be hand-in-hand with implementation of the model. And I think one big change that needs to happen at the Department of Education, at least from my perspective, would be that the Department of Education would be more receptive toward feedback from teachers. And I think it needs to go beyond that to being that they're seeking out feedback from teachers. I'm not aware of anyone. One thing, you know, my wife used to teach in Lake Oswego School District, and the superintendent, Bill Koresh, teaches one class each term, in addition to being the superintendent. And I think that's a tremendous, tremendous way to stay in touch with what's going on, not hearing something passed down the line. You know, Mr. Colangelo was talking about, things going down the chain of command and the bureaucracy and things like that, and how things can change over being passed from person to person. But I really think that's an important thing, would be to have direct communication from people who are doing teaching to the Department of Education along with that.
Excuse me, we're under the call of the House, so we need to leave. I will give the gavel to Martin. And two things that you need to accomplish in my absence once Dr. Conley completes his testimony and answering your question. At our last meeting, you had a back-home assignment. I would appreciate it if you had brought your concerns in writing to give them to Jan. Jan will be working on the work-study group so that we can start to move ahead. The other piece of one work study group that will be chaired by Representative Urbelaar is the issue dealing with mandates, so that we can now begin to start to focus on some of the concerns that you've raised, and we need to begin to go in that direction. So with that, I need to go to the call of house. Good luck.
Being in the same position, are there any other questions that we can direct at Dr. Conley that will help clarify the quality education model as presented to us to this point? That might be helpful, Andy.
Andrew Pate again. I guess this may be a really stupid question. I was unable, due to a conflict with school activity, to come to the last meeting. What exactly is our purpose regarding this model, I guess, is my question. Are we to give suggestions on what exact things are put into the model as it stands now? And then what I've heard from Dr. Connolly is that since it's not a formulated model that's in practice somewhere, since it's not a tangible thing in a school that we can go to, that we're trying to avoid specifics is what it sounds like in a lot of ways because of the variety in different local communities. But what what suggestions are being looked for us to make on this model? Because I'd love to give lots of feedback, but I'm not sure what the exact answer to that is.
Now that we're left with the citizen members of this legislative committee, it's pretty hard for us to, I think, delineate exactly what we're going to be doing. Glenn?
I just have the letter from the Speaker of the House. Do you want me to read the 7 points? He has them?
He doesn't have one.
Oh, this is not the one we got recently. This is the letter dated May 11th. The one that showed up.
Yeah. It's my understanding, besides what is in the letter from Speaker Snodgrass, is that this committee will be breaking up into work groups to work on different pieces of the model so that we can then present, I think, to the next legislative session, the assessment of how we see the model fitting into what's going on and making any recommendations of things that might be included in the model or things that we would like to see maybe adjusted or changed within the model. That's my understanding. Glenn, did you want to delineate a few of the points that
I just wanted to read through them because I think it's important to think about them. Does everybody still have a copy of this letter?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're all sitting there with a copy?
Yeah.
And I guess we don't need to read.
Okay. I'm afraid having been left here, without the legislative members of the committee, we're kind of at a point where, I'm not sure we can certainly not make any decisions about what we think we should be doing. It's my understanding that this might be the last meeting of this group until the session is over. I don't know whether that's true or not.
I had heard that rumor.
Yeah, right. Okay. So we're not real certain. Maybe you can help us out by telling us the length of what our commitment is in order to come to some closure on why we were brought together initially.
Chair Bronstein, members of the committee, as I recall, there was an initial letter, and I don't know whether you got it, but it talks about September of 2000, that we would be completed by that time. And so beyond that, I think things are pretty open. The chair would like to work in work groups. I'm trying to put together a little worksheet pulling out each recommendation or each assumption that's in the model and just going through it and maybe talking about whether you think this is a good idea, we don't need to spend any more time on it, whether you need me to research something additionally, or whether that would be a good work group topic and actually kind of review some of the elements. I know that we haven't gone through things in a real systematic page-by-page way yet, and I know I've been kind of writing questions and notes in the margins, as I'm sure you have been doing. And so maybe those work groups would give us a chance to further explore that.
Can I make a suggestion for all of us? Maybe it would be helpful if you sent out to each of the members, especially those that are not here and based in the Capitol, the different topics of the study areas, study groups, the interest groups. Then we would be able to respond best on what we think would fit either what we could bring to the table in terms of our own personal knowledge and experience in those different areas, as opposed to just generating some ideas and concerns we have and sending it to the chair. If you could let us have those topics ahead of time or how that's going to break down, then we might be able to respond to those and then decide on which study group or interest group we might be interested in. Does that sound like it makes sense to the members of the committee here? It sounds like we're going to be breaking up into smaller groups and then coming back together, I think, maybe in the fall or sometime later on. Does anybody else have any suggestions? Would that be the easiest way to try to chop up our work into sensible pieces? Yeah.
And I don't believe that the work groups are, I haven't seen a list. I think we're real open to what the work groups could be. So if you have some input and have some ideas, you could get them to me and we could take that into consideration, including Professor Conway, if you had any ideas of what you thought that maybe the first group didn't have enough time to spend on any areas.
Question, Dr. Conway. What I just suggested that I would like to see happen. If I made a motion later on, could you get that done? could you, you know, include that in the model, recognizing that it's an expansion of it, but something that I think, as I listen to people and as I go, I've gone around to the schools, like I said, some of the things people said today, I just heard them this morning, this afternoon, when I went to elementary school and high school, sex thinking. So it's out there, and do you think you could expand upon that?
Ms. Gertenrich, I have done some other work in other areas that are sort of analogous with this, but as far as the model goes, I pretty much let Representative Lundquist know I was done with it. I am here basically as a kind of a service and as a courtesy tonight to see if I can be helpful, but I think my intention is to say, you know, vaya con Dios, you know. Somebody else rides the course for a while.
There are other members, too, of the council that you should recognize, besides Dave's role in it, that are here in the audience and have served for a while. Are there any other questions that we could direct at Dr. Conley? Yes, go ahead.
Daryl Truffle, Salem Kaiser. I kind of wanted to summarize here because throughout this whole process that we've been coming to, I always see three areas coming back. The first area is the idea of what are the standards, where are we going, everyone's confused. And if I could just address one thing, I'm in the mathematics field at the high school level, and so this is our first year that we are going to present certificates of initial mastery to our students. And for mathematics, we know what the standards are. They change a little bit. The test gets changed just a little bit, but we know where we're headed. The scoring guide changes a little bit, but we know where we're heading. And so for those of you who seem or who feel like you don't know where this is going, I don't know if you're in an area that is down the road or not. For example, in social studies is still way down the road, and science is just getting on board. And speaking from experience, I felt the same way you did 3 years ago in math. We had no idea what was going on, and it was very disconcerting. It's now become much more apparent what is expected, and so the stress is not as great as it was. Yes, the expectations are high, and that's a stress in itself. But now that we're there, we know where we're going, and it's all right. The second issue that always seems to come back here is the idea of this accountability that's tied in with the model. And I wrote down on my notes here, accountability versus money, because that's really what we're talking about. The model offers us money in exchange for some accountability. And I guess I would tie that to, if I gave my students an extra day or two for review, I would expect better results on the test. And I see that same thing here, that if someone is going to say, look, here's more money to get your curriculum aligned, here's more money to hire an extra teacher, here's more money to do what you think you need to do, then I don't think it's way out of line to expect some type of result back. You know, I would try to shy away from what we expect 10% every year or something, but I do think some type of improvement should be expected, and that's not too far out of line. And then the third one that seems to be coming back here is the implementation part of it, and I guess that's just kind of everything altogether, but I would like to see this push forward. I believe the model is good. It does have, it can't be, it's not going to be perfect to start out with. And again, an analogy would be textbook adoption. For those of us who have gone to textbook adoption, the textbook looks wonderful. We teach through it the first year, and holy cow, we've got to bring in all sorts of supplemental materials. And oh, I didn't like that section, and that took too long. And the second year you go through a textbook is completely different from the first year you go through a textbook. And I see the same thing happening here with the model. I don't think we should be scared because it is not perfect right out of the chute. And maybe just take all those things into consideration. And I think you've done a wonderful job, Dr. Conley, and you know, thank you for that.
Madam Chair, and Dr. Conley, and everybody on Pat Watson Salem, I was communicating with the woman in charge of communications for the Salem School District, and in her note back to me, she indicated, she said that that the estimated funding level recommended for the full implementation of the model is one of the funding levels used to create speculative revenue lines in Salem-Kaiser's proposed budget. that's encouraging news. Now, granted, they've got to recommend budgets at different levels, not knowing what the funding level is going to be. So, you know, that's always a concern, you know, revenue and taxes and all that. That's always an open issue. But at least it's being looked at in the way that we're hoping, that it's a model to help us. Heaven knows. I need textbooks and, you know, in my Christmas area, you know, on a day-to-day basis, I can calculate over $600 of my own money in printing costs this year because I believe the students needed it, and by George, I bit the bullet and did it. And, you know, it happens all around the world. I mean, everyone has a story like that. But I'm encouraged to hear that coming back when I was asking for feedback and concern. I think it's going to get down to the local level. It's what's going to happen in our district, what's going to happen in our building as to where the monies are going. And that's where we've got to have our influence and our advocates. And some of us don't have much of an advocate. We don't have specialists in our areas to pull us together. That's been eliminated. Or we're together with areas that seem analogous in one way and not analogous in another way. I'm together with all the lectures. Yes, I'm together with art. And, you know, in areas like this, and that's foreign language. And it doesn't seem like they have much of a connection, but we're small groups. And so together, we're a decent-sized group. That's what makes us put together. So that's the only logic to it. And so we really don't have an advocate. But maybe this model can be the closest thing that we're going to get to saying, look, we do need textbooks. And this is how short we are with the number of kids coming in. Please use that as a consideration when budgeting.
Madam Chair, Ms. Moss, one thing you might want to be aware of is the Greater Albany Public Schools are using the model as the basis for their budgeting process. So you will have a district close by that is going to try it, and if the model, that level of funding is adopted for Greater Albany Public Schools, they will fund to the model's expectations. So you'll have a district you can take a look at.
My apologies for the side conversation. I need to go to another committee function, and so I will turn the gavel over to Vice Chairman Thompson, and she will continue the meeting. We're getting close to time for adjournment anyway, but I do want to thank you, Dr. Conley, for being here and answering our questions, and hopefully if we have other questions in the future that you will be available to come and share your wisdom and your insights and information.
The drop of a hat.
And I do apologize. I understand that Jan explained to you that we did have to go to vote, and it was mandatory, and we knew that was going to happen, but unfortunately, we didn't quite get finished here in time.
Madam Chair, when will we get the final?
I don't know the answer to that. Representative Taylor or Representative Winters will have to respond to that.
The final model? When is that going to be published?
You know, I had no idea. We had hoped that model that was going to be published today. That was the letter that you released. I understand that there's still some just editorial, grammatical kinds of issues within the document, but certainly doesn't change the content, as I understand the discussion.
Well, Madam Chair, there may be two or three other people who know as well or better than I, but my understanding is within a week. I had two different conversations today with people who I think are knowledgeable about it, who indicated it seemed to be within a week.
Do you know?
I had understood that all the editing had been done, and that it was waiting for approval for the money situation and whatever as far as other respect it was, you know, the publishing would occur and all that, you know, how many copies there would be, and those kinds of administrative details. So I had understood the Bible.
The permission to publish was granted on the 3rd of June with from a speaker with a 48-hour turnaround. So we had hoped that that is what was going to be available today, but something has
stop that development from the council, so I'm not quite sure what it is. And it's Mrs. Cox. Did you want to make some comments, Suzuki? Should you certainly? You want to come up to us?
People pick you up otherwise, because we can hear you. For the record, I'm Sal Cox, sort of an educator, I guess. Currently at Sias Law High School. I wanted to make two comments to the teachers. One is that all of you are post-STEM teachers, and I think that's something that needs to be recognized. I'm also a post-STEM teacher, and some of the people on the council that developed the quality education model were pre-STEM teachers, and I think there's a major difference between the two, not in terms of education or academics, but in terms of what kinds of requirements are being expected. The second comment I want to make is that the 90% figure, it's been neat to sit and listen to all of your comments, because these are all the comments that, some of which were made and some of which weren't in the council, that really need to be said and need to be heard. And I remember when Dr. Conley gave the quality education model report to the Senate Education Committee, and I think it was Senator Gorley's first question was about the 90%. Who are the 10%? And I remember going up afterwards and saying to her, I had a student, it's the first time in 16 years of teaching at the time, that I ever wrote a letter to a parent, and I said, I am now going to do for your child what I am paid to do, because I have done other things that I wasn't paid to do for, at that time, 1.5 years. In trying to get a mentor, I got several mentors. They lasted about a week, and then the student would drop out of the mentorship that I arranged. I arranged after-school counseling and tutoring with the school, what the school had available, and with me. And I won't go through the whole long list. Career visits on site, just trying to get some motivation going. This was a bright student who was doing basically nothing. And I also remember that the student's mother came to me with a letter in her hand because I had mailed it. And I had mailed it, and I can relate to this, Ms. Roth, in tears, because I had never really said, to me, to go back to what I'm paid to do is giving up. And I went to Senator Gorley and I said that, and I was pretty emotional when I said it. And I said, I don't know what percentage in every school there are, but we're not talking about special ed kids when we talk about the 90%. The law has a different, not a different standard, but a different set of expectations for special ed, anyone identified. But what do you do? And when you put this much time in, I have 186 students a day, and I've got one student that's taking that many more hours a week. And at what point do you say enough is enough? And I had not done that before, and it was very difficult. But there is that percent, and we're being held accountable for those students as well. And yet that's a one human story, a heart story, in the midst of all these academic standards that are being held. So in terms of the model, I think remembering, and Dr. Connelly said this several times too, in the testimony, I've heard him tonight as well as other times, it is a model. It's what we'd like to see happen, and I'm not even sure the number attached to the model is realistic for what the model puts out. And it includes art and music and all those things, but what the teachers are saying, if you'll allow me, Representative Hobson, to this panel of legislators is very important to be heard, because it wasn't always heard when the model was being put together. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I assume everyone is aware that she was a member of a group that put it together. I think it's about closing time, and unfortunately, we haven't come to a good closing or even defining exactly where we are and where we're going. My understanding is that Representative Winter said to you before she left that she wanted to encourage folks to get in their questions, their list of interests, so that staff can put together some work groups. And I don't know the status of that right now. Jan, have you received some people?
No, I have not.
Okay. Well, my understanding from, perhaps, Jan, you can explain better. You may have talked with Representative Winters about what she's trying to put together to get the work groups
set up?
Well, I don't have the list in front of me, and my impression was that it was somewhat malleable, and it was
It was at starting possible areas, teaching strategies in the model, budgetary concerns of the model, assumption critique, ancillary cost analysis, whatever that is, accountability concerns, 10% failure expectation examination. I mean, this was April 27th.
You could give the ancillary analysis to the math teacher over
there. I know.
I just wanted to make a quick comment. I think what might be easier for us in terms of trying to work this out in terms of assignment would be for Jan to maybe put together some kind of communication to us of these interest groups that will require us to respond and maybe send it back to her. So that way we can then begin to start working on a timeline for how we would go about these work groups and being able to at least sign up for areas that might interest us or areas that might be within our expertise.
And I could leave blanks at the bottom, so there was something that wasn't on the list that had come up that you were interested in, and then some of the areas didn't have anybody sign up for, you could make some adjustments.
That would be great.
And then could you give us a copy of the phone numbers and maybe addresses of the committee members? I think once before I was asking about
that. Yes, if I have them all. I'll be, I passed around a note one night that a lot of people were gone that night.
Mm-hmm. All right, if you don't.
I probably do. Have everybody's number, but
okay, we'll get
somebody object to having their phone number out?
I suggest emails too if you have that information.
Yeah. Dr. Conley has another comment.
I'm sure you want this 10% quote unquote failure rate, I think is somewhat misunderstood, and perhaps that if that group is constituted, I'd be glad to either chat briefly or put something in writing on that. I won't take up your time now. The model is not based on 10% failure rate, and I won't take up your time now, but I'd be glad to explain the logic and the rationale of all that.
Thank you. Did you have a comment?
What Daryl said and the way he summarized it and what Jennifer said earlier just made me think of something that I hope that you guys, gentlemen, would think about before we meet again, and that is the heart. This is my perception. The heart that it takes to teach a second grader how to be a person and how to grow up and how to feel good about themselves and just to be a person versus the heart that it takes to teach math in high school. Those are two different things, in my opinion. And they're enough different that that's going to be a factor in the implementation of this model. And so even though, and I'm not critical of this, although everything that I say probably sounds like I am, everything that I say and anything sounds that way, I care about the heart that each teacher has in their classroom to get the job done for each kid. And I think that there's enough differences there that we're going to have to be concerned about communicating amongst ourselves, let alone communicating this model from some place on the distant hill to the individual school districts and schools. And you made me think about that today. I just wanted you to know that.
Thank you. Somebody also needs to fund our state education department so that they're able to do what it is they need to do to help the school districts also, and they're not funded?
True. Both of you.
I think maybe we can make those recommendations, Madam Chair, if we can, that by the time we do our summary report for the legislature.
Yes. I would ask, make sure that you have your personal communication information into Jan so that if phone numbers or emails or whatever are appropriate, we'll do that. Representative Winters informed me that the next meeting, because of the constraints and everything over the summer, will be August at the earliest and perhaps the fall. But in the meantime, we very much would like to put these work groups together and even perhaps get out some initial information to solicit from you for sharing when we do get together as a group. And I know you're in a big, big hurry, and it might be time to go, but being an old process person, high school counselor, the whole nine yards, you'll have to forgive me one indulgence since I do have the gavel. And I'd like to take about 10 seconds to sum up how you're feeling about, can we go forth, can we do something with this
because we're not going to see each other for a while, and I hope that there is some enthusiasm. I heard a little bit when I came back in. And what I'd really like to do is just to kind of go randomly rather than around the room, and there's nothing wrong with passing, of course. So if someone would like to start, as soon as you do it, we'll get out of here.
Well, I heard this comment. I think Gandhi said it, that if there's going to be a change, it's going to start with me now. And I think as educators, that's what we have to do.
Personally, I'm kind of looking forward to being able to comment on the model and have some basis in which to be able to convince those that make these decisions about our jobs and what we do and our students and their families and parents. But hopefully it'll have an impact on them. But I'm not so sure that, you know, the politics of the whole thing might prevent some of that. But I'm personally looking forward to at least being able to express myself about having something to grab a hold of and put in front of people to start a really great conversation about what it's going to take to build great prototype schools that will hit all students in Oregon from preschool up to age 21 or whatever it takes, so that we can really match the rhetoric at which many people approach their interest in promoting good education.
I was considering how, as teachers, we often have such deep-rooted passion, and many for longer years than I have been flowing on these things. And so, as we talk in general, I sense that it's hard to leave with a sense of closure. But as I look forward to some smaller groups where we really have a focus of what it is we're supposed to do and be talking about, I think we'll find that there are some things that we can accomplish and recommend. I'm looking forward to the more specifics.
By saying the way you're giving the chance to talk, it's giving me a chance to go on a tangent that I've been wanting to go on. But I think that unfortunately the model is based on the idea of state control of the money and until that can be given back to local control, I think it's pretty difficult for us to solve this problem. And in addition, where we're getting that money from, and here's my tangent, but currently most of the education dollars come from lottery money. And to reverse the phrase of, you know, throwing good money after bad, we're throwing bad money after good. And I'll leave you just, I'll shorten my speech so I have to worry about that, down to thinking about where we're getting that money. And this February, we celebrated our 100th day of school. And to celebrate that, the children each get to bring 100 of something to represent the number. I had one student who is a free lunch student who has very little, and he bought 100 losing lottery tickets that had all been purchased in the last month. And, you know, the kind of people that buy lottery tickets are the lower economic people, and you're going to keep continuing to make a good group of people to buy those tickets with the education system we currently have. Thanks for letting me go on it.
Anybody else?
I'm just really glad that we keep using passion. In my first meeting, I mentioned that I think one of the elements that makes for good teachers and good learners is passion. We have to have a passion for what we do. I try to instill in my students that I want them to have a passion for something. It doesn't have to be my subject area, and I'm very clear about that. But hopefully that they will be able to connect to a lot of different areas because of what we collectively are doing. And by we, I mean the whole community. We're teaching in the classroom, but we're all doing our ideas. I got into education because I thought that there was a national need. Okay, under Kennedy, that certainly was indicated that we need good teachers. We need good people out there. There's a shortage of foreign language teachers. I feel like I've got a mission. But the more I'm involved in this, the more I realize it's not the education as much as the role models for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what Jennifer was talking about, and many of you, that we as role models, all of us, are having much more influence with what we're doing more than much we're saying and the lessons. One day, I threw my entire lesson plan out last week, and I taught about something that's related
And it has to do, and I realized these kids weren't getting this anywhere else, and I felt this was the day I could share this with them. Thank you at the end of the period. Thank you, this is one of the best things we've had. I don't know, brother. You know, what's this? But there was a passion in that. And also, it's a kind of big worldview that pulls them in to see we have a place. We're not the entire thing, but there's a place for what we're doing in the classroom, and we need to kind of laugh at ourselves about this and say, you know, we all fit in here somewhere, and let's find our spot. Anyway, so I'm really encouraged that we have such fine people working together on this committee with good good intent. And even though we may differ in the way that we execute all of this, but I think if we can have that attitude, we're going to make it.
I think we're all here because we care about kids and teaching, and I think it's an excellent opportunity for teachers to have a chance to respond with our decision makers about what will be best for kids. And I think we have an excellent document to work from, but I do think it's very helpful to have the voice of the people who are in the trenches with the kids trying to make this all happen. So this is hopeful. And we certainly do need to make some changes in Oregon.
I guess I'll take the prerogative of saying thank you. As the only legislator left here, I can very clearly take off my legislative hat and put on my educator hat, and I'm delighted to do that and to be with all of you and appreciate and respect all of you and all that you've said. Anybody else? Last chance.
I want to thank Dr. Conley for
all of
his time and knowledge. I know he's affected me a lot with the past projects as well as this.
He's such an academician that it just seemed to go right back to the page. I'm sorry.
This is for fear of being the pastor of this group, but I really think that the whole idea of saying the Pledge of Allegiance to saying one nation under God is one of the motivations of why I'm here. I wanted you to know that, and I think that it's why a lot of you are here, even though we don't talk about it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to say that.
Thank you. Anybody else? I'm going to hit the gavel. Thank you all.
Thank you.